And welcome back to another episode of The End of Religion, a podcast exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus. My name is Bruxy Cavey. I'm teaching pastor at The Meeting House, a church for people who aren't into church.
I'm Tim Day, senior pastor of The Meeting House.
And Tim and I have not received any hate mail from the last podcast, no letter bombs, no death threats. So we are taking this as a sign from the Lord God Almighty that we are commissioned by him to record yet another episode of The End of Religion. Or it could just mean that nobody listens.
Nobody's listening.
But that's all right. We're excited to be able to say a bit more. And we're walking through the chapters of the book, The End of Religion, using that as a discussion point for us. And hopefully this will be valuable for those of you who are listening as a especially if you have a book club or discussion group, or just for yourself if you want to dig deeper. And we are at chapter 2. We've talked about the preface and the introduction and chapter 1. So we're at chapter 2 today, which is entitled Religion, Spirituality, and Faith. Today's podcast is, for many of us, going to be just what the chapter is. It's a significant chapter that kind of lays the landscape out for the book as far as our use of words is concerned. We're going to be talking about definition of words, how we use words like religion, faith, grace, church, spirituality. So that's what lies ahead for the next few minutes. And let me talk a bit about the word religion, Tim, and then you take the word faith and lead us through that. The word religion is really, like many words, very fluid. It's a word that's very elastic in how it's used, very pliable, like the word trunk. It can be used to refer to different things in different contexts. So when engaging in a discussion about religion, sometimes, in fact, most of the time, it's really wise near the beginning of the conversation with someone to say, how are you using this word? What does religion mean to you? Then you can have a discussion or a debate or an argument or whatever it is about the actual concepts you're dealing with, not with just word labels. And so we talk about this in this chapter. We talk about it in the footnotes as well. And if you want to dig deeper into that tendency for people to end up having arguments about words, also check out the epilogue, where we'll talk about that there. But for now, I'm using the term religion in the book, and we are in this discussion refer to reliance on any system of salvation. We talk about this in this chapter as well as in the questions. We remind you of that in the questions of the chapter. Reliance on any system of salvation, a system of rules, regulations, rituals, routines, a system of tradition or allegiance to a particular institution or denomination or label of an in-group that has the truth versus the out-group. Any system of salvation, the idea of God becoming one of us to himself be the way to God, is really a person coming and saying, here I am, right here. There is no way. There's nothing between us. It's just you and me. And so we see Jesus as God personally inviting us to deal directly with him rather than going through any system of salvation that is the intermediary between us and God. And that's what the rest of the book is going to unpack. But we're talking about the reliance on that. Now, to be clear, some people will use the word religion positively to refer to that direct connection. Some people will say, well, I had a religious experience. And by that, they mean I've had a direct encounter with God, and I do on a regular basis, or it changed my life. And so it's good to, again, clarify how people are using the word. We're not talking about, we might maybe use the word faith or spirituality to talk about that direct connection, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. Also, some people may say, so are you saying that we shouldn't have any tradition or any institutions or any of those groups in our lives? And we talk more about that in the epilogue and in the footnotes, but I'll just say this. By using the word religion, we're talking about reliance upon those systems. We're not saying that any system or any sense of organization is a bad thing, but we often emotionally bond with those things as though the things become the way to God. And that bonding and bondage is is what we're challenging through our response and use of the word religion. So hopefully that clears the way for what we're talking about with religion. Instead, we're talking about, well, we're using verbiage that is more in line with what Jesus talks about. He doesn't use the word religion. He used the word faith or belief or trust, which is, they all are translations of the same word in the original languages, both Hebrew and Greek. So, Tim, tell us a little bit more about some of the options and how we would use the word faith.
Yeah, faith is similar to, as you said, the word trunk. It's people today in common usage actually use faith a couple different ways. One, they'll talk about faith in terms of a sort of a set of doctrinal beliefs. Are you, do you believe in the Christian faith? And what they mean there is there's a set of doctrines, a theological position,
creeds,
and they would say sort of the Christian faith or the Muslim faith, and we'll talk about a particular sort of system of belief as a faith.
It's a package. It's a collection of beliefs strung together into a cohesive worldview.
That's right. And there's some churches that out there that would really have that as a high value set. They're doctrinally concerned. They want to make sure every I is dotted and T is crossed. Mm-hmm. And so they maybe say, you know, are you being true to the faith?
Yeah.
And what they mean by that is, are you being true to this doctrinal position? Another way that faith is used is more, it's almost on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's on, do you have a sort of an emotional conviction? Do you feel convinced that this is true, what you believe? And so they'll talk about, do you have faith? A lot of times this is more within circles, let's say, that emphasize supernatural or healing, things like this. And do you have enough faith to see God work? Mm. And for them, they're talking about faith as this inner sort of, I'm resolved, I'm convinced, I don't have any doubts.
It's an emotional passion for what you say you believe, which means the absence of doubt.
Absence of doubt. Yeah. And so for a lot of these people, it's like they feel like, oh, for me to have faith, actually, I have to push down my doubts. I have to push it out of my conscience. I have to whoop myself up into some
repression,
sort of frenzy.
Repression is good for the soul.
Yeah, and I just have to be this. And they see having faith in that context as getting themselves to a place where they just don't doubt.
Yeah, right. So someone who's wired a bit more intellectually, or perhaps like a Doubting Thomas, who just has a lot of questions, Doubting Thomas being one of those disciples that Jesus did not rebuke but affirmed as one of his disciples. Someone who's wired that way may often just feel like, I don't have enough faith because I always have doubts or questions. And I don't feel as emotionally passionate all the time as some of my people, my peers, my tribe.
Yeah.
And so they'll often struggle with whether or not they have the faith that they're told they should have.
Right, where if they're in the more doctrinal church, they could be true to the faith.
Yes.
And have all their...
They have questions, but at least they're true to the faith and what they say they believe.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So it's interesting how that word is used. Now, in terms of how we want to use faith, or our understanding of the historical biblical context, both Hebrew and Greek, really neither of these two are probably a good use of the word faith.
Mm. We're not saying we disagree with any of those. We need both passion and we need clear teaching. But, yeah, the biblical usage is still somewhere else.
It's somewhere else. And maybe the word that we could use to help clarify that is the word faithfulness. Hmm. Within the Hebrew context, this is actually, it's almost interchangeable. And when you think of the word faithfulness, what comes to mind? It's more of a relational context. Hmm. You're always thinking about, if you're being faithful to someone, you're thinking about, it's a relationship where I am showing myself trustworthy within the context of that trust relationship. And so if we think in terms of the word faith within the biblical context, I think the focus of it, the emphasis isn't really, am I doubting or convinced, or am I doctrinally correct or have the right set of beliefs? It's really, am I in a relationship with somebody, and am I being true to that relationship?
Hmm. So faith is saying, I have enough belief or trust or faith in you that I'm willing to be faithful to you, that you're worth taking the risk. I'll spend my life being faithful to you because I have faith in you.
That's right. You just think of being full of faith or faithfulness.
Right.
Is that concept of my life is fully committed, demonstrating that commitment in trusting you in all things. Now, if we come back, there's a story I'd love to tell about this that I've often told to help capture what is faith.
Okay.
To emphasize the relationship. A little girl plays with her dad. Whenever she comes downstairs from the upstairs, and before they leave, he says, "Honey, it's me." And she jumps off the stairs. Now, when she's a little girl, she could only jump a couple stairs into his arms, and he'd catch her. Mm. As she got bigger and she trusted him more, realized he'd always catch, and she would inch up the stairs, go one step higher and higher, until finally she's about halfway up, and she's just diving, and she knows that her dad's big, strong arms will catch her, and she's safe. And so he says, "Honey, jump." She jumps. Now, a tragedy hits the home, catches on fire. Everybody gets out but the little girl. She's stuck up in her bedroom. They knock out a window, and there's not time for the rescue vehicles to come. There's smoke. She's scared. She can't even see because she's blinded by the smoke, but she hears her dad, and he says, "Honey, I'm here. Jump." And she knows, I can jump out this window. I can't see where I'm going. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm as scared as I've ever been. Yeah. But I know that voice.
Yeah.
And even though I can't see him, I know he'll catch me.
Hmm.
And that is, I think, faith. It is that I know the person and I trust them. And as a result, I can abandon myself to them.
That's awesome. And it's not irrational. It's based on previous experience, on evidence. There's evidence leading up to that decision. It might be blind faith in the sense that
you can't see anything right now.
Right now, can't see all the, but there is evidence that is leading you to say that this leap right now, mm-hmm. this leap of faith is actually the wise decision.
It's the wise, and it's rooted in, the thing is, it's not rooted in immediate evidence around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's rooted in a person.
Yeah.
And that person is present, and you trust that person. So a lot of times within the narrative in the New Testament, they're talking about, let's say, there's a great story of a miraculous encounter where Peter walks on the water, mm. Matthew 14.
Mm.
And when he's out doing this crazy, like, surfing sort of supernatural thing,
mm-hmm.
he starts to sink, right?
Yeah.
And then Jesus says, you have little faith, right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
somebody would say, okay, how's that word being used there?
Right.
You know, is it that he wasn't whipped up emotionally?
Right.
Is it that he didn't have his doctrines right? Well, how? Mm. What is the doctrine of walking on water? No. In that context, it clarifies, it's all about relationship.
Mm.
And Jesus is saying, don't you trust me?
Mm.
Don't you trust me? And I think that's, when we talk about faith, you see how different that is from religion in mm. terms of focus. And we're talking about Jesus doing away with religion,
yeah.
but calling us into faith.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's not calling us into an emotional state. He's not calling us into a doctrinal position. He's calling us into actually a trust relationship just based on his heart. Do we know him and do we trust him?
That's great. And again, there'll be those people saying, are you saying that doctrine is wrong or that we shouldn't be emotional about? And
no
we're just
no.
first thing first.
First things
trust
first.
Trust in Jesus, and then everything else gets in line with that.
Mm-hmm.
Or else you create a kind of idolatry of doctrine or emotionalism.
That's
that
right.
becomes the faith to you, rather than having Jesus in the center. We just are processing currently at the Meeting House a series called The God Debate. Now, that may not coincide when people are listening to this. Once you put a podcast up there, people access it for some time. But in The God Debate, we're walking through some of the atheistic writings that are currently popular within our mm-hmm. society by authors like Hitchens and Harris and Dawkins and Dennett. And one of the things that really gets my underwear in a knot is the complete...
don't want that.
And I don't want that, no. is almost the intentional disregard for how the Bible uses the word faith and what it means by mm-hmm. faith, as we've just been talking about. Dawkins especially will call people who are believers faith heads and defines faith as a belief that is contrary to evidence.
Yes.
The evidence sends you in one direction, but when you cover over your eyes and take a blind leap in the opposite direction, that's what we call faith, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about or what the Bible's talking about or what Jesus is talking about when he uses the word faith. It's actually evidence leading you to make a relational commitment.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like how a dating relationship can then graduate to a marriage. When you're dating, you're in an evidential time of your relationship. You're looking for the clues that says this is a person worth becoming faithful to and committing my life to. And yes, you're relational and you're romantic, but you're also looking for the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you finally do get married, it is a leap of faith. But it's not an irrational leap of faith. It is a leap of trust into this relationship with the person, but based on the evidence so far. So Kierkegaard talked about taking a leap of faith, and I would say you need to run the ramp of reason before you take the mm-hmm. leap of faith. Faith gets practiced when the evidence, when the reasons to believe, when your rationality has led you to conclude that there is a person at the other end of this investigation.
Yes.
When you believe that the universe ultimately has personhood, has mind, has consciousness,
mm-hmm.
has love at the other end of the equation, when you finally come to the point of allowing the evidence to take you to that conclusion, then faith is how you at that point engage with the person at the other end. And so I think it's important right off the bat to say faith may be different than religion, but it is not different than being rational, reasonable, logical in how you think.
Right. And in that place of having faith in that person, the test of maintaining that faith is faithfulness, which means it's staying in that relational harmony and partnership, working together.
Yeah. If someone listening to this is wants to, we want to move on to the word grace now. But if someone wants to dig a little deeper into the concept of faith, you can jump ahead to chapter 20. If for some reason in your book club or your group, people are still stumbling over this, we come back to it a little bit more in chapter 20 in the book, and so you can go there. I'll also mention a couple of Bible passages. We'll mention just one for now. Matthew 11 verses 2 to 6 is a story in the Gospels where someone who is a Christian leader actually begins to doubt whether Jesus is the Messiah. And this is Matthew 11, verse 2 to 6. And he doubts whether Jesus is the Messiah, so he asks Jesus, "Are you the Messiah?" By the way, this is one of those clues that the Gospels have a fundamental historicity to them, because if they were just making the story up about the powerful God becoming flesh and visiting, walking among us in the form of Jesus, they wouldn't talk about one of the early Christian leaders actually doubting whether Jesus was really the guy or not. But Christ's response to him is fascinating. The question is, are you really the Messiah? Now I'm starting to doubt. And Jesus doesn't say, you know, get rid of your doubts. He doesn't chastise him. And neither does he just say, yes, I am. Shut up and believe it. He says, here's the evidence. Decide for yourself.
Yes.
That Jesus has, he's like the original Christian evidentialist in that sense. He is calling people to assess the evidence rationally, and he's quite confident that the evidence points in the direction of there being a God at the other end of the equation. As we have faith in this Jesus, trust in this Jesus, he comes with this concept of grace. Again, that is something opposed to religion. Now, faith and grace kind of meet each other in the middle. They're like two ingredients in our relationship with God. You pour both into the same test tube, and you have an explosion of relationship, really. So now, what's grace? How does that work in the whole spectrum of things?
Well, one of the primary issues of our relationship with God is that he is a perfect, divine, and we are flawed. And so how did the two come together? It's sort of an oil-water sort of scenario. And I think the word grace, when you talk about creating that explosion of relationship, I think grace is what allows the two to come together. Mm. The word itself, grace, is defined different ways. It's related to the same word gift. Some people have described it as unmerited favor or free gift. Mm. And the essence of grace within the context of the biblical narrative is really just getting something completely for free. It's just a complete expression of me giving you something that you've never deserved, you've never earned, you've done absolutely nothing to warrant, and I'm just giving it to you. Mm. And even in the midst of maybe significant offense, that really I could almost have reason to give you nothing.
Yeah.
And one of the great stories, we referred to this earlier in a previous podcast, on the story of the prodigal son and the older brother, the two brothers. Mm-hmm. Both were experiencing grace by their father. The one experienced grace because he went away and blew everything, completely offended the family, completely offended his father, comes home a complete wreck. The fact that the father would give him a ring, wash him up, throw him a party, even before he can really apologize, is just complete grace. It's just complete gift. It's a lavish type of love that just pours out freely.
Yeah, so in that story, the son, in his own mind, was setting up a system of payback. I will go home and begin to work it off. As a servant, as a slave of my father, I'll work off the offense and the hurt and the money over time. And yet he gets met with grace. That's grace.
That's grace. And the older brother received grace when he actually has that mindset of the younger brother now. All he is working. And the father comes and pleads with him, says, leave your field, leave your work, and enter into a party, enter into a celebration. And he doesn't judge the son, but pleads with him. That was a demonstration of grace. And so I think we see in this that grace for us is essential to having a faithful trust relationship with God.
Hmm.
And that God's expression of grace to us opened the way, sort of parted the waters, broke down all the barriers.
Yeah.
And wiped out any need for any system.
Yeah, it's a thoroughly irreligious concept, grace is. God reaching down and pushing. It's like parting the waters, but he's parting all the religions. He's pushing them from one side to the other and saying, no, I'm just coming down directly and giving you what you're just not able to work off. I'm not asking you to be my religious slave and to somehow become, you know, to earn your way to heaven. I'm coming here to just gift you. So we've got faith. When we've got grace, there's a great passage from the New Testament in the writings of the Apostle Paul, Ephesians 2, verses 8 to 10, that actually bring those two concepts together and talk about how they work out in our relationship with God in a thoroughly irreligious way. Do you want to just walk us through that? It's in the chapter, Ephesians 2, 8 to 10.
8 to 10. We've said this before, Brooks. You've said this many times. Context is everything. Hmm. And in this particular verse, which is really pregnant with meaning, is set in a larger context. In Ephesians chapter 1 to 3, is the first section of Paul writing to the early church. This was a letter that was circulated in Asia Minor through a number of churches, most scholars believe. And so it's a very general letter. It's not responding to a specific problem. It's basically Paul talking through, okay, how is the human heart changed from the inside out? How does that happen? Let's talk it all through again. He's at the end of his life, and he wanted to be really clear. He's probably working with a scribe when he was writing this. And just wanted to be crystal clear. And so each of these verses here is loaded up with meaning. The one we've picked out is one of those. In Ephesians 1 to 3, it kicks off by saying basically this. Look, you're rich, you're filthy rich, and you don't even know it. And he's writing to help the believers realize everything that they have that they may not be aware of. And the image that I've used when talking through this first part of Ephesians, because it talks about us being seated with Christ in a royal position, like being seated beside God at the right hand, like a prince on a throne. That's sort of the image, or a princess on a throne. That's the image. The parallel that I use to describe this passage of Scripture, this section of Scripture, I should say, is like a baby being born into royalty. When that baby is born and sitting up on Queen Mummy's lap or King Daddy's lap up on the throne, that baby has no awareness of anything. They don't know where they're born. They maybe know they need a diaper change or they're hungry, but they're completely oblivious. Yet as that child grows, they're like, wait a minute. Wow, all the servants in this household report to me. The royal army will take my command. All the royal lands belong to me. I'm a billionaire. And they come to this awareness of what has come to me.
Yeah, I've been set aside for a special life.
I have been, and all of this is mine and didn't earn it. Didn't work for it. It was just completely given. And so Paul is saying here in Ephesians 1 to 3, he says, let me tell you how wealthy you are. Let me tell you how you received that. Let me tell you how you've gone from basically being dead and didn't even know you're dead to this incredible position of free relationship with God and all that means for you. And let me tell you my own story. And then he finally concludes. He has two prayers in there. He says, I'm just praying you get it. I'm praying God turns the light on the inside of your awareness, and you just get it. And it's like, wow. So here in this context, when you understand we're talking about Ephesians 2, 8, this verse is nestled in that section.
It's great that you point out that context, because it pushes back against one of the criticisms of religion, especially the Christian religion. And it may be a valid criticism of the religion, which often, I think, misses the teachings of Jesus. And that's the Christian religion induces a fundamental identity of guilt and shame, that my identity, my starting point as a human being is that I am a sinner and I should be ashamed of myself, and that I'm so sinful that there's nothing I could even do that could possibly please God. All of my righteousness is as filthy rags.
Yes.
Even if I try and do something good for God, if I try and live a good life, he looks down at me and says, no, you make me sick for even trying to live a good life. Now, that verse out of Isaiah, righteousness is filthy rags, is often quoted out of context. It's a very specific rebuke against Israel for their hypocrisy. And yes, if you go through the religious system and you try and be religious and you go through all of the righteous deeds of a religion while at the same time living a hypocritical double life, then God will say, yes, all of your righteousness is a filthy rags to me. You're being a hypocrite. It's a very good rebuke that God gives that to Israel. But that's not his base setting for understanding who a human being is. We often forget the Bible starts, first of all, by saying we are image bearers of God. We're made in his image. That's our understanding of who we are. Now, liberals will push back against the conservatives and say, you conservatives are saying we're basically sinners. We don't want nothing to do with that. We want nothing to do with that. So we will say we are basically just wonderful, shiny, happy people who are made in the image of God. And both have a side of the truth, but are ignoring the other. So we're our base setting for understanding our identity is that we are infinitely valuable to God, made in His image. But we are not only image bearers, we are broken image bearers. After Genesis 1 and 2 comes Genesis 3. But Genesis 3 is not our starting point for understanding ourselves. So we're precious to God. And I'll just say one other thing and then toss it back to you, Tim. Because I think that this is a great setup, and this is one of the critiques of religion, is that is even Isaiah saying that all of our righteousness is a filthy rags is – and that gets quoted often within Christian fundamentalist circles. There's much we could say, but just one example in the New Testament that would push that aside is Acts chapter 10. Feel free to read that on your own sometime, where Cornelius, who is a pagan, he's not converted to Judaism or to Christianity yet. He is someone who's a spiritual seeker, you could say, and believes there's a God and wants to reach out to that God sincerely, although he's not he's not converted. He is someone who lives a good life, who gives to the poor, and who prays to this God that he wants to know better. And an angel appears to him and doesn't say, Cornelius, don't you realize that all your righteousness is like filthy rags to God? He's so displeased with you. Instead, the angel encourages him and says, your gifts to the poor and your prayers have ascended to heaven. They're like a memorial before God. He's accepted this. He's pleased with this. Now, it's not enough. He still needs to hear about Jesus, and God brings Peter to tell him about Jesus. But God is encouraged by people who are doing their best to reach out to whatever the reality is. And many people might be listening who are spiritual seekers and should know that God's excited about that. He's pleased with that. And then he wants to bring a Peter along to help complete the journey to tell the Corneliuses out there about the good news of Jesus. So Paul gets to that here in Ephesians chapter 2. Sorry, that was my partnering in setting up the verse you're about to look at, Tim.
No, that's great. So if we want to pick up on that, because what you've been saying, Brooks, here is really just articulated clearly by Paul as he's writing to the first Christ followers. Picking up at verse 6 before we get to verse 8, he said, "And God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus." And you say, what is going on there? What he's saying there is essentially when Jesus went through that death and being brought to life, that resurrection experience, he was sort of cracking open a whole new passageway through death, conquering all of the barriers that could stand between us and God. And as he returned to God, he was, in a sense, taking us with him. Everybody who'd be in a trust relationship with him were sort of being dragged along or being brought along without us even doing anything. It was something that he did for us. So we're like that little baby who just wakes up born into royalty. And we didn't even realize we're seated with him in a royal position, in a spiritually royal position. Now, as we read down then, he says, in order that in the coming ages, and that means in the future revelation or the future generations, he might be able to show the incomparable riches of his grace. In other words, this whole process of us being rescued, yes, as image bearers, broken image bearers, rescued out of our distant fallen position where we're not in relationship with God, being rescued up into this very high, lofty position. What is this going to reveal? What's that going to show? Well, it's going to show how incredibly gracious God is, how incredibly nice he is, how incredibly kind he is.
Imagine that. God's a nice guy. What a concept.
And so we get to see this in this message of Jesus, of this radical, almost foolish, lavish love of the Father, as we saw in the story Jesus told of the prodigal son and the older brother. Now, then he goes on, with that in context, for it is by grace, that word, free, unmerited favor, that gift, that complete gift of God, that you have been saved, rescued, restored, healed. That word saved is a big word.
Yeah, made right with God.
Made right with God and made right in and it's not just sort of a legal accounting like you've gotten off. The notion of being saved is holistic and it's long-term.
Your life is now in connection, in right connection with God, the way it should be.
That's right, and all the good that comes with that.
Everything
going to flow from that.
So by grace you have been saved.
Through faith.
There's the other ingredient.
Yeah, so if this is what God is offering to me, grace, that I might be saved, how do I then sort of close the deal, reciprocate? And that's faith, trust. I just simply say, God, I trust you and I receive it. Now you realize how incredibly subversive that is to religion, that says you actually have to go through something, adhere to some sort of right doctrinal positions, and then once you get yourself all sorted out, then God will accept you.
Mm.
And no, it's actually God being proactive, coming to us, wanting to give us something free, and then we just essentially have to say, I trust you, God.
So you don't have to necessarily take the classes, read the book, study the courses, then become intellectually, doctrinally sound enough to qualify. Neither do you have to manifest the appropriate emotional response at an altar to show that your heart is genuinely sincere and all doubts have been banished from your mind. Rather, you just say, you trust enough to believe this could actually be true and apply it to your life.
You've heard it enough. You put enough pieces together that when you hear this message of complete grace, it makes sense. And you say, do you know what, God? I'm willing to trust, like you said. Now, what's really cool here is in Paul's writing, he actually stops and he says, we got to make this really, really clear.
Hmm.
So he inserts something. He says this. He says, for you have been saved by grace, for it is by grace you've been saved through faith. And he stops his, and this is not from yourselves.
Hmm.
This is a gift of God. So it's almost like he has to slow down. He says, look at everybody. We always think we have to do something.
Right.
He said, just want to make it clear. This has nothing to do with you other than just you receiving.
There's no system of salvation here. There's no proper allegiance or traditions to maintain in order to. We just trust, and that's our receiving. Faith is our receiving. So if you give me a gift, I just have to believe that it's not poisonous or there's not a bomb inside it. I just, as I reach out and receive it, I'm trusting you. I'm saying, hey, thank you.
Then he goes on to say, not by works, so no one can boast. So God's being really clear. I don't want to have some sort of pecking order. As soon as you create a pecking order, some sort of ladder to climb, there's always going to be someone higher up the ladder looking down on someone further down in the ladder. That's one of the problems with religion, is it creates not just an in and out group, it also creates within the in group a hierarchy. Of who's holier, who's closer, who's further along, who's wiser, more enlightened, more anointed, whatever your phrase is, has your doctrine sort of. And he says, nope, wipe that all out.
Okay.
It's a completely level playing field. There's no hierarchy. No one can boast. And then he goes on and says, and he really turns the corner here, and religion tends to make us obsess about ourselves in terms of getting ourselves cleaned up. And as a result, religions often promote a religious mindset within a community or within a person, a real absorption with self-concern about, have I gotten it all figured out? Have I gotten everything sorted out in my life? And, oh, I'm screwing up in an area, and I've got to get that under control. God won't be happy with me. All that sort of thinking. Here in verse 10 of chapter 2, it really turns the corner and says, look, this is the reason why God is doing this. He says, for you are God's workmanship. Or I love one of the translations says, you are God's masterpiece.
Yeah. It's a word there he uses that means a beautiful work of art.
A beautiful work of art. You are God's beautiful work of art. Now, why did God create you? And why is he giving you this gift of grace? Why is he doing all this? He says this, you are created in Christ Jesus, in that trust relationship through Jesus, to do good works, to do amazing things, which God prepared in advance for us to do. In other words, God was planning ahead and has a vision for my life, for your life, that says, I want to see you live my love and demonstrate that to other people. Mm-hmm. And so he says, look, if you have to worry about getting yourself all cleaned up, fixed up, put all together, you're going to be spending the rest of your life as your own sort of self-improvement project. You're never going to get there. You're never going to get it all. So let's get rid of that. Let's get our minds off religion. Let's, again, clear away all that rubble. And let's get back to what a father would actually want his kids to do. What is that? Start loving the way the father loves. Within the family context, do I care about my youngest son, 4 years old, having everything sorted out and how he's compared to Rachel, who's 9 and knows a bit more, but she doesn't even have it as together as Nathan, who's 9? No, I don't want any pride. I don't want any comparison. I want them to learn how to love each other and how to take care of each other, especially if one of them's hurt and vulnerable.
And they've done nothing to qualify for your family, but now that they're part of the family,
that's what I want them to focus on.
That's right. And there's ways of living as a day, as a member of the day clan, that you want to ingrain in them, not so they can earn a position within the home, but those so they can express the lifestyle that is the most healthy.
And so you can see in that, that simple image, you can see why Paul is praying. I just pray you get this, get out of that mindset of trying to fix yourself up.
Yeah.
get out of that mindset where you have to earn something from God and realize this is all a free gift. This is grace. This is why you can just have a trust relationship with God and just get to the business of loving other people.
I was talking with Robert Buckman, who is an atheist, earlier this week, and he's written a book, Can We Be Good Without God? And one of the things he said is that grace, from his point of view, ended up becoming a very dangerous doctrine because the church then twisted that into saying, because you're saved not by how you live, but just by believing, it really doesn't matter how you live. Live any way you want. And you know you go to heaven when you die. So it actually encourages a lack of morality. It encourages more egocentrism because you just say, hey, I'm the king's kid. I am the prince. I can do whatever I want. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think in that, that's again where you have to put faith and grace together. Because grace is not given to us so that we can go do whatever we want. Grace opens the way. Once you fully understand how much God loves you and the nature and power of love, self-centeredness really starts to have a bad taste, if I can say that. Once you understand how wonderful it is. But anyways, once you have that sense of grace, then you have to get the notion of faith or faithfulness. It isn't one or the other.
Right.
So you need the both of them together. Grace enables us to live in a faithful relationship with God. It doesn't enable us to say, wow, now I can go do whatever I want. Yeah. The person who understands grace that way is actually somebody who is like the Old Testament, you use from Isaiah, your works are filthy rags.
Yeah.
It is really a hypocritical approach.
I can go live the way I want as long as I also say the right prayers and say I received this by grace or whatever.
You turn grace into a non-relational term.
Right, non-relational. Because really, it is about a relationship. Once we understand that, if we compare all of these things, I would say this to our listeners, when a lot of these questions come up, just compare it to a relationship, because that's what Jesus would do. It's actually not that complicated. When you look at, say, a relationship between a husband and wife,
it's the same thing.
If you were to say, if you were to live in that marriage always asking the question, how bad of a spouse can I be before you will divorce me? You know, what can I get away with? Then that's actually not a marriage. That's not what a marriage is. But if you actually see just what an amazing person you have married, just how wonderful they are, then your thoughts are not how distant to you can I become and still not have you divorce me. Your thoughts are how can I plumb the depths of this amazing person that I have the privilege of being married to? How close to them can I be? How can I kind of snuggle up to their soul? I've married someone who's awesome. When you have a clear vision of how wonderful they are. And so there's something about actually being getting our eyes fixed on Jesus, having a clear view to this amazing person as kind of a glimpse of then of God, of God's heart, that I think drives us in the opposite direction of trying to get away with stuff, to say, no, I'm catching a vision of the life you've called me to now in response to your grace. And I want to live that life because a life that he calls me to has got to be better than any life I would make up on my own. Well, we've talked about religion, faith, grace, walked through Ephesians 2. How are we doing for time? We're at like the 38. That's a long podcast. It's a big chapter. It's an important chapter. Listen, you've talked before about five different kinds of religion that can become abuses distracted then, and even maybe now people who say I'm a person of faith might still get wrapped up in one of these kinds of religion. Do you want to just quickly give people a picture of some of the ways that we can be distracted back onto the path of religion rather than the path of faith?
Yeah, we use the chapter, the notion of licking the cup.
Yeah.
Which I love that image of trying to find satisfaction out of the structure rather than drinking from it. So if we talk about five different cups that you can lick.
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
Just to use that as a mental hook. Mm. One of the writers of Jesus' life, Luke, wrote a two-volume series, Luke and what's called Acts. It's a sort of a two-part series in the life of Jesus and the first church. So you walk through that, you see that he actually chronicles five different groups that become challenged or confronted by this message of Jesus. And they represent five different religious approaches to life. And I'll just run through them real quickly. It's probably not an exhaustive list. There might be more, but at least these are good starting points.
That's what you've noticed.
Good starting point. Behavioral religion. One that is legalistic, concerned about how you act. That was typified by the Pharisees of Jesus' day, And they're worried about it's basic behavior management, behavior modification. How you act is really important.
Right. Make sure you avoid the right sins.
Yes.
Well,
and,
avoid all sin, but just that's holiness, is what you don't do.
You don't do. Often tied with this is sort of legalism of what you believe, but it really is measured in how you act. Hmm. And are you doing the right things?
Right.
A second is a ritualistic religion, which is maybe more typified by the temple cult. And
the Sadducees
and their interest in going through the ritual. And there it isn't so much on how you act Monday to Friday or Monday to Sunday. It's did you go through the ritual of going to church? Did you maybe take the Lord's Supper, or did you go through some sort of sacrifice? You might see this in other world religions too, where it may be they assume that you're going to screw up. As long as you go and offer your offering.
Right. You do confession or make a sacrifice, participate in the Lord's Supper Mass or whatever it may be. That would be like a Christian version of the first century Sadducees.
Which are ritualistic.
And make your animal sacrifice at the temple.
The next group is political. There's a politicized religious movement called the Zealots. Mm. And they have really baked together religion and politics. Mm. And have said, really, for sort of God's community to come on earth, it has to come politically. And so they put all their time and efforts, and they see salvation not in terms of having all your behaviors personally worked out or going through ritual. It's around really establishing a political order.
Would the Herodians fit into that?
Herodians as well, yeah, the Zealots.
Right, so getting the nation fixed is very important for bringing about God's will.
And you'll see they give their whole lifetime, energy, everything to trying to get a national...
Okay.
Sort of a national religion or a national, or get their nation right with God.
So you've got the Pharisees are avoiding sin. Sadducees, it's about the religious rituals. The Zealots, the Herodians, about getting the nation politically aligned. Yeah.
Then the fourth one is a magical religion. If you have a behavioral, ritual, political, then this is magical. And that's Simon the Sorcerer. And for them, salvation is through getting the divine power flowing through you. Within Christians, it might be in ministries that emphasize healing and power encounters. And it might in other world religions be like the witch doctor. They're concerned about holy people with holy power, holy buildings. They tend to be very, everything is a relationship with God is basically turn in magic into...
There's formulas.
It's formulas. It's like a light switch. Do you turn the light switch on or off? Everything is controllable if you have the right incantation or you have the right person or if you're in the right place. And so the system is really mastering what do you need to get the power encounter with God.
Okay, how does the flow of the service happen? What are the right words or intonations to use in your prayers? Often this kind of magical form of religion is bonded with the emotional form of faith
that
we talked about earlier. How do you kind of, they wouldn't talk this way, but I think as a critic of that, I would say, how do you whip up the right kind of emotional climate to see miracles happen? And again, it's kind of manipulating the spiritual atmosphere in the same way that a pagan might manipulate the elements of nature in order to produce magic.
Right. It's very much the same thing. Often tied with a holy person, too. They'll have holy people that have this power.
Yeah.
And so if you need a power encounter, you go to them or go to their service.
Yeah.
And so that's magical. Okay. And then the fifth one is intellectual. And this we see in the Epicureans and Stoic philosophers that are confronted. And that there's an intellectual version of religion, which is enlightenment focused. Have I really acquired mentally the right truths and ordered my thinking in such a way that I enter into salvation? So you see this both within Christianity, within the first century context, but I think we also see it globally. There are religious systems that have different focus. Some focus on behavior, some focus on just going through ritual, symbol, art, some focus on the political efforts to get a nation organized under their religion, others focus on the magic, power encounter, experiential, how do I feel? And the last one is more intellectual. And here the thing about these different cups, these different systems, I think you can see it once you have it mapped out this way, is really just appealing to us. What is your personality? What do you like? If you're an intellectual person, you're going to be drawn towards an intellectual religion. If you're an experiential person, you're going to be drawn to an experiential religion. If you are politically motivated, you're going to be drawn that way.
Yeah.
And so, in a lot of ways, you know, religion, I think, is really just a at the heart, a human projection.
Yeah.
It is us trying to order our worlds according to what we naturally like, and either finding a system that aligns or trying to build a system that aligns with how we think.
Yeah, or projecting that then onto our deity of choice.
Our deity of choice.
Just because we say, I follow Jesus, doesn't necessarily mean we follow Jesus. We still might just be following our own religion, and we're projecting that upon the Jesus deity now.
Yeah, it's sort of, we talk about humanity being made in God's image.
Mm-hmm.
I think religion is where we turn the tables
right.
and we make God in our image.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's important, I guess, again, to point out to some people who might be listening with objections that we're not saying that any one of those aspects of a fully orbed relationship is wrong. A moral behavior or having some traditions or having an emotional passion or right doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just to kind of meet full circle, all of those may be part of a fully orbed relational connection with God, but they themselves are not the way to God. They just may be aspects or expressions or stylistic elements of a relationship, but they're not the relationship.
Right, and that, I think, is where when you don't have Christ and a true relationship at the center, we tend to go overboard in one of these other areas, trying to change ourselves by maxing out in one area.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like that's what creates the sort of weird obsession, the compulsive behavior, and the bondage.
That's great. Again, we've got a theme for this podcast, or really for the whole book, but when in doubt, just compare it to a relationship. All right, so if I felt that in my relationship with my wife, I always had to project maximum emotion at all times in order to make her know how sincere I was, right? So, you know, she buys some new clothes or she shows me a new dress, say, hey, what do you think of the dress? If I felt I had to jump up and down and say, no, it's amazing, what amazing dress, I can't believe it, you know, you look at that, and just, you know, tried to, you know, work my way up to tears to prove my sincerity in the dress, I think she'd whack me upside the head or have me committed, say, listen, I just was curious on your opinion about the dress, and that's great. On the other hand, if I just tried to assess the dress technically and the angles and the lines and you know, what are the principles of fashion that might like make the dress look appropriate upon, you know, on her, and turned it into some kind of a scientific or intellectual discussion, that would miss the point too. For her to just say, I'm just curious on you. You know, just one element of relationship is dialogue about real things that are in the room, you know, real things between us in our relationship. And sometimes we'll be emotional. Sometimes we'll be processing something that's intellectual and doing that investigation together. But what a shame to make either of those something that we feel the need to manifest on a regular basis.
You see why, you can see why people will obsess when they think this is my path to salvation, right? I have to get this all right to be saved. Mm. Once you're relieved of that, and Jesus comes and says, by grace, I'm wiping that all out. You don't need to. Then when you come back to all those different aspects of saying, well, I want to see my life change in a positive direction, or I want to have a good understanding, or I do want to have an awakened emotion, all of that can find its right balance within a relationship. It's all valuable. Yeah. It all plays a part. It all has its seasons.
Yeah.
But it fits within this larger relational context where we don't overattach, don't become compulsive, and don't judge other people. One of the biggest things is not turning our own journey in relationship and stage relationship into a basis to start measuring everybody else. And because whenever we are obsessed about measuring our own status with God, we inadvertently almost always begin to measure everybody else.
That's a great point. I have to say two things at this point. Number one is my wife rarely wears dresses. Why am I saying that? Because if she listens to this, I know that what Nina's going to say is, why did you picture me in a dress? I don't know. She's a jeans and t-shirt chick, and I love her for it. And secondly, this whole rational versus emotional approach as two extremes reminds me of, you know, Spock and McCoy, right? Standing on either side of Kirk.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got, they're always at odds with each other because both interpret being an appropriate person. I was going to say a real human, but that doesn't apply to Spock. But an appropriate person, a valuable person, as taking either being in touch with your emotions or being in touch with your intellect. And it's like we have religious expressions of Christianity that are completely Vulcan or completely, you know, Bonesian, you know, right? Anyway, those are great. We see that in the Bible, in the Gospels and in Luke, these religious temptations. And we see that within the Christian faith today.
The cups that we're tempted to lick.
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than drink from the living waters.
Hey, as we move towards concluding this podcast, let's talk a little bit about Well, we can pull this one off real quickly. I said at the beginning we're going to define church. That's really
yes.
talked about in the chapter. But is there anything you want to say about defining the term church?
Just to reinforce what we said before, it's a relational word. It means community.
Hmm.
It doesn't actually mean anything that people assume with church today.
Yeah, right.
In terms
right.
of, for the majority of people, think of buildings.
Right.
And if not, then a denomination or some sort of organization.
But it's still important then because Jesus calls us into community. I was speaking in Ottawa this weekend on responding to the new atheism, and someone asked a question, is it okay to not believe in God and not want to go to church but still follow Jesus? Which is a fascinating question, to say I want to be a Jesus-following atheist who has nothing to do with church. And I can understand someone wanting to, you know, process that, to which I responded, yes, and as you follow Jesus, first thing he will do is say, I want to introduce you to your Heavenly Father and to your brothers and sisters, right? To say, I'm all about getting you connected with God.
Mm-hmm.
And then I am also all about getting you connected with community, with the church, but not the church meaning an institution.
Mm-hmm.
That's us projecting a later definition on the word. The church means the gathering of the people, the community, and your spiritual brothers and sisters. And again, there may be people who are listening to this as single individuals who are outside of any spiritual community.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's starting to resonate with you and you're saying, yes, I'd like to pursue this further, one of the things that would be appropriate for you is to find
mm-hmm.
some expression of spiritual community just as a starting point, whether you can process this in friendship with others or in a group or in a church as a spiritual community. Spirituality, you know what, for the sake of time, let's... Spirituality is one of those words that gets used just differently by different
mm-hmm.
people. Some people make it an endpoint destination. I'm a spiritual person. We talk about this in the book. I think some people may use the word spirituality in a similar way to Jesus used the word faith.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do, I think that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to find a modern word to say, I am about connecting with the divine, but I'm not about just blindly following a religious system.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's their heart, then I think it's a great use of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it depends on the heart behind it. Okay, last thing then, is some of the aquatic imagery that comes up in the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few Old Testament prophecies that use aquatic imagery to talk about the coming of the Messiah or the world that waits ahead for them during that Old Testament time as something very positive. Those references are mentioned in the text in the book. And then Jesus, when he comes, he picks up on that aquatic imagery to drive home
mm-hmm.
his point. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the image of the water within that geographic area is obviously very important, as it is anywhere in the world, but particularly in an arid place. The notion of a river is a beautiful thing.
Mm.
It's where life comes.
Mm.
And so when the story of the scriptures open in Genesis, this beautiful garden where we're set for intimate relationship with God and each other is brought to life through this river flowing through it. And that image really is a picture. Sticks throughout the text, and the notion of a life-giving river flowing is equated with God's sort of blessing flowing into a region and making something dead come alive. And so it's a great mental hook. This reappears in the Promised Land as they looked forward to a garden-like environment where they could live as a nation and have community. And then it's brought forward again in one of the prophecies towards the end of the Old Testament, Ezekiel 47, that you reference. This a mental picture of the future where Ezekiel says, do you know what? The temple, this religious structure that that they saw as a meeting place between God and them as a nation,
mm-hmm.
one day a river would flow out of it down the mountainside. Trees that would be these miraculous, life-giving trees that could feed people will bear fruit in all seasons. And this river will flow and will be restored. It's a beautiful picture of living water restoring a barren and dead landscape and producing these fruit-bearing trees. Now, as we come into Jesus' teaching and his life, he says, I am the living water.
Hmm.
And he declares, and now that for the first... Jews, that would have been hard to understand because they were really thinking, you know what, practically, this actual temple,
yeah.
I'm expecting some sort of miraculous gusher coming out, geyser coming out of this thing
yeah.
and making this nation come alive. And they really were always translating these prophetic images from the Old Testament in a very physical, practical way for them as a nation, them and their temple, them and their people group. And Jesus had to come along and say, no, listen, I am living waters. In fact, right at the end, when he has a showdown with the religious establishment, he goes in and turns over the tables and shuts down the sacrificial system for a day. Mm-hmm. When he comes out of that sort of confrontation, there's a passage that follows that has many times been misinterpreted because they don't understand the context of the river, of this living water. Jesus comes out from cleansing the temple and then sees a tree, that a fig tree, that fruit tree of that area, fig tree, that was not bearing fruit.
Yeah, this is a weird story.
This is a weird story.
If you don't understand the context.
And he says, he curses the tree and says, not only is there not fruit now, it will never bear fruit again.
Interesting.
Okay, and then he says, if you have faith, back to this word, faith, if you have trust in God, the size of mustard seed, that little, you can say to this mountain. Now, what mountain is he talking about? It's the Temple Mountain. It's the mountain that he was walking down from having cleansed the temple.
Right, because it's right there. So this mountain is the mountain that they're just walking down from.
Descending down. He says, you can say this mountain, be cast into the sea, which means you're going to be utterly destroyed.
Okay, let me just track with you so far then. Now, the mountain that the temple is on in Jerusalem that represents the religious system of the time, not a huge mountain, it's like a big hill. But I live in Hamilton, and we call it a mountain. It's still like a big hill, right? So and there's an Old Testament image that the water from the temple will flow and create luscious greenery. And so outside.
And particularly fruit trees.
Yes.
Ezekiel's clear, these trees that will bear fruit in all seasons.
So there's a fig tree, one of the just outside of the temple. And it looks like it should have fruit, but he tests it. No, it has no fruit. Curses it.
Says it'll never have fruit.
Never have fruit.
Which means that prophecy in Ezekiel will never be fulfilled.
Way they think.
They're thinking of it as something physical for that nation.
Yes.
And so then Jesus says, even beyond, will that prophecy not be fulfilled the way you think? He turns to the mountain, to this symbol of religious establishment.
Yeah.
Says, if you have trust in God, you can say to this religious establishment, be destroyed. Mm-hmm. Now, where is it being destroyed? 70 AD, the temple would be destroyed by Romans. And to be honest, Jesus takes credit that that will take place.
Yeah.
But I think the more important place that it needs to be destroyed is in our own hearts, in the disciples' hearts, rather than their own addiction to a religious establishment that left them in bondage. Jesus is saying, if you can just get it, that it's just about trusting God and having that trust relationship, you can actually cast this mountain of religion out of your life. And you know what? All the stuff that you thought was going to come from religion, it's not going to come that way. The good things that you want to see, and that tree was symbolic of it, that fruitfulness, that productive life, that healthy, holistic life, it's not going to come that way. In fact, in the book of Revelation, the writer of Revelation comes back to that same image and retells the story and says, the end of Revelation, he says, he again tells, the river is going to be flowing in those last days. There's going to be trees bearing fruit, but do you know what? There's no temple.
Right.
The river flows from the throne of Jesus and how he tells the story. And again, he's coming back, retelling the Ezekiel prophecy, but now with the understanding, the insight of Jesus, and saying, that's right, that temple has been destroyed, that religious establishment has been wiped out, that living water is flowing from the source of living water. Jesus said, I am living water.
He's the living water. He's the water. He's the temple, in that sense, from which the water flows.
So it becomes a powerful image of relationship. And not just a relationship, it's using water now and the drinking from a cup. It is actually about taking the life of Jesus into the very essence of who you are. It is drinking in the very presence of God into the core of who you are. And in that place, not only being satisfied, but being changed from the inside out so that you become an agent of life. That it,
out of you then, the rivers begin to flow.
That we begin to flow. So we become conduits of this transforming grace. Again, coming back to Ephesians chapter 2, we then become God's masterpieces, and he has good works established for us to do. This water flows through us, rather being obsessed with our own, like I say, self-improvement project that religion often tells you have to do. We actually become freed up then just to become agents of grace, agents of life, agents of this living water.
It's beautiful. It may seem like complicated imagery to someone who's never walked through this before, but it's beautiful in how Jesus gathers up the imagery of the religion of his day and uses it to pronounce the end of the religion of his day. You know, and so in the end, Ezekiel's prophecy does mm-hmm. come true, just not in the way anyone expected.
It becomes true in a relational, spiritual, transnational, fully inclusive community. Mm. It becomes, in all the essence, it's all there. Mm. But it's simply broken out of that sort of racist, yeah. You know, sort of
tribalistic,
View of community.
Yeah.
And in Ephesians chapter 3, when he's praying at the end, I love this. He says this, "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom his whole family in heaven and earth derives its name." Mm. When he's praying, this is this image of this incredibly inclusive, loving Father that just welcomes everybody into community. And for anybody who wants, he says, "I've got grace." Mm. And all I'm asking is for that trust-based relationship, that faithfulness in relationship. And now let's go change the world together.
Wow, that's beautiful. This has been fruitful for me, Tim. It's been great hanging out with you and talking through this.
It's been great. I hope you've enjoyed it too, all of you guys listening in.
Yeah, that's right. Listen, next time I write a book, we got to do it together. This is good stuff. Thank you for tuning in. And listen, as far as we're going to sign off now.
Yeah, we don't know how to end.
We still don't. That's becoming our ending. So we were talking this time, though, we actually remembered to talk about it before getting started. We would like, if you're listening to this, we would love some ideas on what would be an appropriate way to end the End of Religion podcast. If you're listening, please write to feedback@theendofreligion.org. feedback@theendofreligion.org if you have an idea on how we should be ending these podcasts. Actually, let me just say, even if you don't have an idea, it'd just be great to know if you are listening, if there are people out there. You might not have a question or anything to say, so then just write an email and say, "I'm listening." That's all you need to say. That would be great just to know that you're out there. feedback@theendofreligion.org and also if you have an idea on how to end this, because obviously we're hurting for one. Until then.
Bye.
Bye.